Today is June 11th, 1985. My name is Irene DeWitt, and I'm an alcoholic. Today, our friend in AA has agreed to share her story with us on tape to add to our important AA archives. I'll ask her to identify herself, and we'll go from there. Okay?
My name is Lucy Bell Gookian, and I'm an alcoholic, and I also have a drug abuse history. My sobriety date for both alcohol and any other drugs is October the 17th, 1954.
Very good, Lucy. And we can go from there by asking you the question that I know is important to me and of interest to all of us, is how did you get yourself into AA and how did you hear of it?
I heard of AA first through the Jack Alexander article.
Mm-hmm.
That was many years ago, and I was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, with my alcoholic husband, that I learned to identify him as an alcoholic through the Jack Alexander article.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at that time, me, I had no problem. When I began to recognize alcoholic patterns in others at some later date, I was instrumental in referring my first husband to AA, and then also there was a traveling salesman where I worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I called AA when he was out on the trip one time, and he got real bad off in a hotel in Mobile, Alabama, and I called the AA in Mobile and had them go see him, and he got sober. A couple of years later, I was having some problems and began to recognize all the signs and signals in myself and my own drinking pattern and everything that I had run across with both my husband and a few others. And I began to sort of nose around.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine, she says, maybe you've got one of these, what they call alcohol problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes. She says, well, I know a couple of AA members. Is it okay if I ask them to come to see you? I said, well, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so a girl came and caught me in my favorite drinking bar one night, and she was drinking. And she said that she had been told that I was looking for AA. So what she wanted to do was to give me a pamphlet and share her experience.
Right.
And she said, me, my husband gets wild jealous when I disappear drunk. And I have found a little tool I use. I call AA when I'm ready to quit. And they all come over and get me and nursemaid me and call my husband and tell him how bad off I am. And said they're going to look after me for a few days. Then he feels sorry for me and he didn't fuss at me. And to pay him back, I go to a couple of meetings afterwards, and then they don't see me again till the next time.
Oh.
Since, however, I do have a little pamphlet here called A Way of Life, and it was a little blue book. And she says, I'm going to leave that with you, and you may be interested. She says, it doesn't do me any good. I use it. But it may be something you need. So I took the little pamphlet, carried it home, and threw it somewhere. And forgot about it, because if she was drinking and using AA to get in and out of trouble with her husband, I couldn't identify with that.
Mm-hmm.
So later on, my friend, who had first said she might stuff around for me, she sent another man by to see me, a man this time. And he came in and he talked to me where I worked for a few minutes. And he invited me to go out for coffee with him that evening and so forth, so I went. And he was a very nice gentleman, and he drove me by where they were having an AA dance and had me to look up through the window, and he says, now I go to AA because I'm a morphine addict.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, so, every time I get on morphine, or every time I get drunk and get a hangover, then that calls for morphine. He said, so I go to AA so I won't drink, so I won't get back on the morphine. Well, I couldn't identify with that.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice man, and we were good friends for quite a while. But other than giving me a card with 12 steps on it, we said no more about AA. And I continued to drink a little bit. And then one day, the girl who had originally given me the little pamphlet, a little way of life pamphlet. I was drunk as $400 at lunch one day. I went out and drank my lunch and was afraid to go back to work. So went up to see this girl, and she was just getting sobered up again. And there I met another individual who had about 8 years sobriety. And this was a man, and he and the girl carried me back to my house and had me get under the shower and get myself all showered down with cold water and wash out my mouth and brush my teeth and eat some food and get myself back to work. So I got back to work, and luckily, if anybody noticed anything, they didn't say anything. And so this man seemed to make some sense to me. So he came by to see me a couple of times at work, and he talked a little bit about it. He invited me over to his little cottage on the beach to come over anytime I wanted to, and he'd be glad to talk with me. So I went over there a couple of times, always drinking, never sober. And finally, he took me to an AA meeting. I kept begging to go, and he kept saying, "You don't want to go there. Why in the world would you want to quit drinking?" And I said, "It's just getting too rough. Everything's messed up." So he took me to the meeting, and of course I went in, and that being my first meeting, I had all kinds of images in my head of what AA meetings might be.
Right.
But I thought I was in church, and I looked around me, and it was on a Sunday night, and everybody looked fairly well dressed and clean, and I couldn't see a drunk among the bunch. Not anybody I could identify. Of course, I was drunk.
Where was this meeting?
This was out on the beach. I think it was Indian Rocks, but it was in an old fire station out there.
I see.
I can't remember the name of the group, but I think that was it. So when the little speaker boy spoke from Tampa, and I could not tell too much about what he was saying. I don't remember a heck of a lot of what he said, but I remember I cited that blue pamphlet.
Oh, yeah.
That the girl had given me.
By the May, I remember that.
So that took some of my feathers down. And then along about 58, they came out a survey, the Annals, the American Academy of Political and Social Science. And I got hold of that in the library. And in there, they had the whole thing was on alcoholism. And in there, there was a whole section devoted to AA. And they stated in there, among all the other things, that there were many things about AA that kept people from being able to affiliate.
I see.
And I wanted to affiliate. You know, I had been in, and I didn't want to leave. So I decided that I better find out about that. So they said that, you know, AA's many successes had been eulogized, but his failures had not been scrutinized.
Oh, I see.
So I thought about that for quite a long time, and I'll tell you a little bit about what I did about it later. And then I got some more information. The Grapevine articles used to be real wonderful to me, and every now and then there's a real good one in still. And Bill wrote an article about, I think it was the 1958 Grapevine, called Emotional Sobriety. He talked about all the adolescent behavior we had at 30 and 40.
Right.
That was only becoming for 16 and 17.
That
was another slap on my wrist.
Right.
And then there was a Grapevine article that came out sometime in the 50s. I don't know where it was, fairly early or late 50s. In which Bill, he used to write letters regularly for the Grapevine for publishing. And he said daily for 7 years he contemplated suicide. Well, man, that was a real shock.
Right.
I thought, what is this man? We're all, you know, he's our founder, he's this and that. And what is this man here? He's telling us that for 7 years he could daily consider, hey, wait a minute, I better review here and see.
Right.
And then I realized when I had talked to many members that this is not uncommon for people to have these kinds of feelings.
Right.
And then there was another Grapevine article that I really carried around and waved. I used to get hold of something. You'd think I was Amy Simple McPherson or something. I'd preach and evangelize by the time I would get hold of. And there was that helped me internalize it.
Right.
There was a Grapevine article came out in which Bill talked about how they, when they wrote the big book, in the early literature, that they referred many times to various kinds of religious things, or psychological books, or other kinds of things. They gave us resource information from what they had had.
Mm-hmm, right.
But, you know, it wasn't necessarily the end-all be-all.
Mm-hmm.
And in this Grapevine article, he says, I earnestly implore
mm-hmm.
all new AA members to bring to the fellowship, to share with their fellow members, all kinds of new information. We gave you all we could give you then.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, but it's always more coming, and he says you need to bring that
right.
so that you can increase the information in AA.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I myself have recently finished a book by Anton Carlson
mm-hmm.
called The Machinery of the Body, and
mm-hmm.
he says that has given me more understanding of my own body than anything I've ever run across.
Right.
The physiological aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was running around trying to get up new literature all the time and telling everybody I ought to read this.
Right.
And then another time in the Grapevine, I believe that was also about 58. It was in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Where Bill was looking back over his history.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, you know, that he was astounded
mm-hmm.
about, I believe this was about the 24th anniversary, later than that. Anyway, he was astounded at all the 12 steps that he had so earnestly recommended to everyone
mm-hmm.
and to say to himself that I haven't made any progress on all of them except maybe the first.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I need to review all the 12 steps.
Right.
And I thought that was remarkable. Here's a man who is admittedly powerless over alcohol. He's got a formula we call a program that's printed in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And when he looks back over it some years later, he has to say to himself, he literally hasn't got much past the first 12.
Right.
And I thought that's most interesting.
Really?
At most interest.
Yeah.
Because that's about where I was
right.
at that time. And
so you could.
I didn't feel bad when it took me 12 years to figure out the third step.
So you could relate.
I didn't feel it all.
Really?
This man could go a long time
yeah.
and not get past the first step hardly, then, you know, it was all right for me.
Right. Well, what I'm going to do now, Lucy, is stop the tape and turn it over.
All right.
So maybe we can take a break and
okay.
Then I can talk to you later.
Well, you want me to call you back?
I'll stop the tape and then I'll call you back in about 5 minutes.
All right.
Okay.
Okay,
okay, bye-bye.
The things that I can never emphasize enough when I'm talking to people is you get everything second-handed when you come in AA because you got to listen to everybody else's experience, and that's good and that's the way it works. But there's also so much information that has come out in all the read material. It's not just the big book. There's lots of other things that have come out in AA. And I recommend everybody get everything and read it. Get everything that's published by AA and read it. And pick out the things that you think will be helpful to you. And then go back over them and underline them. And then at some time in the future, you'll remember and try to hunt for certain things, statements and so forth, that you feel you need at that time. So you tell me if you ran across anything you couldn't use it or disagreed with it, put it in your hind pocket, be the thing you'd need next week, next month, or next year. And to me, that's been true. And I know one of the things that I had quite an argument with was just before I made my first trip up north. I made a trip up north primarily to visit other AAs in 57 and 58. Visit other AA groups, other AA club rooms, the central office in New York, everywhere. I wanted to go and find out all about AA everywhere else because I had pretty well exhausted. I guess the members had got tired listening to me down in Miami, and it was pretty good for me to take off and go find out how it is somewhere.
Now, this
else.
Was something you did on your own. Nobody
oh, yeah.
prompted you to do that?
Yeah, we both wanted to do this together. We wanted to see if there were any changes. We wanted to see the similarities. And so we went and did this together. By this time, we were man and wife.
Mm-hmm. Who are you speaking of now?
I'm talking about my sponsor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I had hung on to was from a pamphlet called Alcoholism, the Illness, where they made some copies of some of Bill's talks, and this one was one in May 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great comfort to me because many times UAA groups formulating the old ones that have been around for a long, long time, they become kind of sticklers and dogmatic in their attitudes and their ways of looking at things. And to me, there was a caution all through AA that this was not something you did. There always had to be room for changes, new ideas. And I remember that in this Alcoholism to Illness pamphlet on this particular 44 talk, he said something that then I've repeated at many meetings, and I've had people get up and walk out of a meeting when I would repeat it. And I thought that was, you know, that indicates to me that, you know, maybe we need to widen our view every now and then. And in this little article or talk, Bill had said, at the very outset, we would like it made ever so clear that AA is a synthetic concept, a synthetic gadget. And we draw upon the resources of medicine, psychiatry, religion, our own experience, drinking, and recovery. And then we have put together a society of the alcoholic's own kind where he can put these things to work to stay sober for himself and others. And it was, that's not a direct quote, but it's similar to that.
Right.
I don't know word for word. I never was very good at memorizing things. But to think of it as a synthetic concept, a synthetic gadget, that somehow takes some onus away from some things and kind of places a little on others, and I had to work that one out. But then I realized what he was after, as far as I could see, was environmental influence. One drunk talking to another, the first identity in AA being the individual who's come and staying sober, the second identity being the group. That's where we get from the grassroots, we work to the top, not from the top down.
Right.
And that imprinted quite a good bit on me that it's the environment that we seek, the daily contacts, the home groups that we have that really help. And that was what I had come to the conclusion after I had talked to many people in Miami from many groups. There weren't that many groups up here. But I had been seeking, never mind what people say, what do they do?
Right.
And I was anxious to put together something for myself that would hold me up. While I learned, because I recognized that along with my learning, some things might be kind of earth-shaking, and they had already been, and that I needed some sort of a way to do things that I could handle. And I found something that is still the basis of my AA today, and I'd like to talk about it right now, just a minute.
Right.
And one is, I found that the first thing that all people that stayed sober would talk about as a rule was staying sober in 24-hour compartments, learning to live a day at a time, not dwelling on the past, not anticipating a lot of future, learning how to talk in such a way that it reflected that they were living in the now. And that to me got to be real important because it kept me from jumping way ahead, way behind. It kept me from the crushing thing of having my plans not materialize, of having things go awry, you know, like you go out and you go to start your car because you're going to be somewhere in 5 minutes and then you kick the tires because it won't run and all that kind of stuff. And there are many little things that you build so much on the future sometimes that whenever it doesn't turn out that way, it's very crushing. And so to think of this business of always, it's just not today's business if I can't do anything about it today, and I don't have to carry it over to the next day or anything. When it becomes another day's business, that's the time I have to deal with it. And I can't do anything about 1 minute past or 1 year past or anything else, so I have to let that go except for Is there a lesson I can learn from that particular thing? Is there something there that I need to recognize that may be useful in the future, if I have a future? And so that day at the time was the first thing I grabbed onto. The second thing I grabbed onto was this thing about the environment thing. And that was a home group. Know the members of your home group. AA doesn't conduct meetings. Groups conduct meetings. Groups get coffee together. Groups pay rent on places to hold meetings. Groups are people who come to the meetings. Not an individual and not meetings. Meetings are nothing, you know, without you've got a group support that. Somebody to get you a place and somebody to make you coffee and so forth. Just to say I'm going to a meeting didn't seem to do much. You can visit other groups. You don't visit their meetings. You visit the group and meet the people in it. They are the people. The individuals together make the group, and that got to be real important to me, to think in terms of AA groups. I belong to this group, she belongs to that group, he belongs to the other group. We belong someplace.
Right.
Belonging to AA is very difficult. You know, where is AA?
Mm-hmm.
It's in each individual as they go to their groups. There's no big building and no big thing. There's some service offices and service boards, but there's no AA. And AA doesn't hold meetings. Groups hold meetings.
Right.
And so I got real comfortable with the group notion. That was the second thing I found that people who stayed sober did. They had a group. They belonged someplace. They didn't just belong to AA at large. I finally met a man who was a loner. And I said, well, as a loner, what group do you belong to? He says, I have a group, and I'm listed in the directory. And I said, that's odd. How do you do that? He says, my group is named the Me, Myself, and I group.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes all I have to communicate with is me, myself, and I. So I've got me a group as a loner. I travel a lot. Then I go visit all other groups, but I got my own group. And I thought, well, it sounds crazy, but he's worked it out for himself so that he's got a group. He's a member of AA. He's registered, and he sends money to the central office. And I thought that was real neat. I don't think I'd want to go that far, but, you know, it worked for him, so
right.
I thought it was good. And then I found something else by observing all these people, which I carry forward. It goes with the 12-step work, but it doesn't. Since we don't have 12-step calls every day, most of us are not that fortunate, and I doubt if we could handle a 12-step call every day anyway. But in addition to taking 12-step calls, when we have an opportunity, there's daily contact with new members, new pigeons or babies, however you designate, or some people call them sponsees, new people. There's daily contact with some of those. There's handing out your telephone number and letting people call you. There's telling people when you're usually to be found at home. There's seeking people out, at least one contact a day. And if you're all screwed up in the head or emotionally upset or something, as many as it takes that day to get your head leveled out. So these are the three things that I use all the time. The first one is to stay in the now. Whatever I can't do about something right now, let it go. That's not today's business. And the next thing is to, as much as possible, stay close to my home group members and be sure that I have a home group. I don't go somewhere and wait 6 months. I'll join any group to start with, and if I find one that better meets my needs at some later date, I can switch if I got a good enough reason. And then the last and most important is daily contact, which includes 12-step work when I'm so fortunate as to get it.
Right.
And these are things that no matter what's going on with me, if these are the actions that I do every day and these are my focuses every day, and my weekly meeting of my group, I go to one meeting of my home group. Now, I have belonged to a group that had two meetings a week. I never did belong to a group that had nine meetings a week.
Right.
I don't know how. That doesn't seem, you know, I can't seem to be able to identify with that very well.
Were you ever able?
But I can pick one group, And I can pick one meeting of that group should they have more than one, and I don't let anything interfere with that. I never let anything interfere with my drinking.
Right.
I don't let anything interfere with my home group meeting.
Were you instrumental in starting any groups?
Huh?
Were you instrumental in starting any groups?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, that daily contact and not missing my meeting, and
mm-hmm.
I don't miss my meeting today.
Mm-hmm.
I got to be out of town for good reason to miss my meeting. Not just because Aunt Susie's in town and gee, she's going to leave tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I really ought to stay home with her. No, I wouldn't stay home with her if I wanted to drink.
Yeah. Where did you start groups?
So in Miami, we got to noticing, several of us did. I think there were five of us together. That there were a lot of people down there that were having difficulty affiliating with AA.
Mm-hmm.
They would come and they would stay sober a while and they'd get drunk.
Mm-hmm.
They would find the 12 steps something they couldn't cope with. They would find the religious overtones, something that they were having difficulty with.
Mm-hmm.
They begin to think that instead of a method of staying sober, that this was a method of you had to go out and find a higher power somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of confusion going on and a lot of stuff, so we decided we would start something different.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
In 1958, we started a group called the 104 group,
mm-hmm.
a 105 group. And there were five of us got together and we decided we would have a meeting
mm-hmm.
and once a week, and that we would put the usual notices out.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and it was fairly successful, and some people who had not been able to stay sober began to come there, and with a less dogmatic, broader point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the easier and softer way.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't that way.
Were they discussion meetings, basically?
They were discussion meetings where they brought up their own attitudes, their own problems, no matter what there were, their own feelings about everything,
mm-hmm.
and there was room for all of their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a good discussion meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I decided I needed to learn more about AA. My sponsor, at that time my husband, he'd been sober by then a long time, and I had been sober, this was in 59 and 60.
Mm-hmm.
I had been sober then about 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to think I wanted some more information. And so I went and rented a big house on Miami Beach. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things I wanted to find out was AA seems to be always relegated to old store buildings and to, of course, that's not true today, but to old store buildings and Skid Row addresses and so forth. How come AA people can't go first class?
Mm-hmm.
So I got a mansion out on Miami Beach. I borrowed $1,000 to lease it.
Mm-hmm.
And moved out there and called it Sobriety House.
I see.
It was my husband and my private home. It was not organized as a club or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a 40-foot living room, a 20-foot dining room, and a 20-foot Florida room.
Wow.
So we figured that was meeting space enough, and it was right on the beach, so if anybody wanted to hold meetings on the beach, they could go to the beach and hold meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made our first group out there. And at the end of 2 years, we had five groups there.
I see.
All of them were discussion meetings.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was a panel discussion.
Mm-hmm.
One was an open meeting with a discussion period following, and the others were closed discussion.
Mm-hmm. Now, your panel discussion meetings, how were they set up?
They were set up with questions,
mm-hmm.
written questions from those present.
Mm-hmm.
Addressed to the panel.
I see.
And the panel gave their answers, and then it was thrown open to any comments
mm-hmm.
after all the questions had been answered by the panel.
Now, the people on this panel, who were they?
They were AA members from anywhere and everywhere. We'd invite them to come over and sit on a panel.
Mm-hmm. Was this based on the length of sobriety, the ones that were chosen or invited?
No, it was mostly on the ones who seemed to have a sound basis of sobriety, where they'd been sober 3 years or 15.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And we enjoyed it very much, and I had a man down there who, when I first met him, he'd been dry 14 years, and that seemed forever.
Mm-hmm.
And he got sober about 42, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he described AA to me one time after finding out he couldn't run me out. I told him one day at a discussion meeting, I said, well, you know, I don't have a higher power at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, if you don't have a higher power, you leave this meeting and go back down on the street where you obviously belong. So I thought, you know, he's got fat resentment about something. It must be about me. So I thought a minute, and I thought, wait a minute here. Don't blow your cool. And I thought a minute, and I said, wait a minute. I said, listen. I said, you know, I said, I can't afford to leave.
Mm-hmm.
If higher power is for me, I'll get it sooner or later, and I can't afford to leave. Now, if you can't stand my company at this meeting, you know you can leave. But I want you to know I can't afford to. So he left.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. And he had a terrible time after then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a real terrible time. Went to see him two or three times. He got very ill. Because he went to a bar to try to buy a drink and found after he bought it, he couldn't lift his elbow off the bar.
Mm.
And he really had a hard time.
When you got back to Pinellas County, were you able to start any groups here, or did you just join one that was already established?
Me, I always go to the first AA group I can get to that's closest to where I am, and I join.
Mm-hmm.
Time enough to make groups and stuff later.
Right, right.
I'm not going to run into a new area and run start groups.
Right, right.
Run in and you join whatever's there and you get with it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, over the period of years then, in 1959 to 58, I made my trip up north.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to AA and I verified my feelings of the people who stay sober. What do they do? I would ask everyone I saw, how long you been sober? When did you make your first contact in AA? When was your dry date?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have any health problems after you sobered up?
Mm-hmm.
How often do you go to meetings? Do you have a meeting pattern?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the groups and meetings? What do you do about 12-step work? What do you do every day to stay sober? And all kinds of things. I just asked questions. You know, people would answer me, too.
Right.
That was a surprising thing. Some of them would get a little shocked, and they'd say, well, what do you want to know for? And I said, well, I've got to learn how to stay sober. And I want something that'll carry me through. I don't want to be somebody that's going to be sober 5 years and then come drunk and have to repeat all this mess over again. And I said, I want to know what everybody does. If you've been sober over 5 years, I want to know what you do every day to stay sober.
Right.
So that maybe I can do that, too.
What part of the north was this that you traveled in?
We went from here all through New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine.
Wow, the whole east.
We just went all the way through there.
Mm-hmm.
Visited AA, visited meetings, went to meetings every place.
At that time, then you visited the service, General Service Office also?
Huh?
You visited New York General Service Office?
Yes, I went to the central office up there, and I got to see the original pencil copy of the 12 steps where it was all scratched out and corrected and so forth, and I asked barrels of questions, and I visited the office. It was not like it is now. You weren't blocked off from the office when you go in. Then it was all one big place, and you could see everybody around moving around, and everybody would holler hi, and you'd go in and meet this one and that one and talk to them, you know. Today, they have a tour.
Right.
And of course, you can talk to people, but you go on the tour and you sit and wait till the next tour.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when I went back, of course, I got a little tiny resentment about that. I went back 3 or 4 years ago, and when I went up there and saw that everything was blocked off, and you got a reception room, and you got a schedule of tours, and
mm-hmm.
if you come back at 1 o'clock, you can go on the tour at 1 o'clock, and that kind of stuff, I felt a little miffed. But then I realized, AA is big.
Right.
And it has to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, about 1960, I got hold of a report of a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to think about these kinds. kind of changes. Good, I had given ideas to this.
Mm-hmm.
And going up there and recognizing that things were going to change and that I found some changes in places. Because that the whole theme of that conference sort of was like an era of change.
Right.
And they talked about the kinds of things that, you know, about the being respecting of the past and for the lessons that we can learn from all the past experiences and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But that we also have to be able to drop those teachings when they no longer work or when it's obvious that things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as they're going through that right now, it is obvious now that many alcoholics are newly addicted.
Right.
That many have been placed on prescription drugs and can't get off. That many have to take drugs as a matter of health and welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can no longer stand up and say, you know, the language of this is for alcoholics only.
Right.
You know, what alcoholics? What other side of things have they got going on? And you have to take all that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And their changes on. And of course, being somebody that finds it difficult to make changes, I've had to work real hard on that.
Right.
And so in 62, I left our sobriety house, gave it up, because I'd learned all I could learn from that environment I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to my husband about it, and I said, we don't have any money, but we got a way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
We can fly kites for a living. We'd done that before once, and it was delightful.
Mm-hmm.
We buy children's kites, and we travel around with a load of kites, and we fly them by the roadside, and we collect money, and then we go to the next stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that struck me as a real gypsy way of life. I like. So we went in 1962. We went 18,000 miles in this country.
Wow.
And we stopped and visited AA, research outfits. By that time, I felt comfortable to go any place.
Right.
We went to hospitals, mental hospitals, regular hospitals. If they drew in any alcohol treatment, we went to universities where they were having experiments and research doing into alcohol. We just went everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And got a whole load of information.
What did you observe at that time?
About what?
About what did you observe at that time about
that nobody knows what an alcoholic is.
Oh.
And that they haven't found out yet, and that I don't know how long before they're going to find out.
Uh-huh.
But that it goes back to the same thing we started with.
Right.
If I fit and I'm in trouble and I need to stay sober, then, you know, I have to look at myself for a definition of alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And accept anybody else's when they come in.
Yeah.
Whatever they think they is, they're an AA member to say they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just so much things like that I have learned. And I did on that trip, though, further. I made my further survey. I printed up some little 3x5 cards before I left home.
Mm-hmm.
With these questions on it that I'd ask up in New England State.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, I felt real good. But I felt real bad about something.
Mm-hmm.
My survey, while it was unofficial and covered by no means all AA members everywhere, it sure was broad.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that as near as I could figure from their first meeting, since I didn't stay sober from my first meeting, I never felt put down about it, but I recognized it was nice to know that a lot of other people did.
Right.
But I found out that it seemed to me that instead of 50% stayed sober, that about 0.1% stayed sober.
Oh, yeah.
I said, boy, that looks sad.
Yeah.
I said, I wish I could go redo this thing.
Yeah.
But I'll have to operate on what I found. And I said, if that's going to be 1 out of 1,000,
yeah,
I'm going to be extra careful about everything.
What did you attribute?
I want to be the 1 out of 1,000 that stays sober.
What did you attribute that to?
Large portion is getting bored.
Uh-huh.
Losing their medication and not having any way to deal with stress. Coming up with heart attacks, ulcers, various kinds of stress-type diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Having to get on medication.
Mm-hmm.
Being on certain kinds of medication. If you're half drunk on pills, it's easy to pick up a drink.
Mm-hmm.
There were many factors involved in that, and I said later, it's too bad that I had gone by the central office and got some sort of a official, unofficial, but official recognition that I was going to do this survey and let them have my results.
Right.
But I did not do that. I did this on my own because it was me I was interested in, my learning, my staying sober, and then to share whatever I found with other people. So when I got back home, I tallied up all my little cards, and I said, boy, this is absolutely amazing. I hope it's inaccurate as hell, and I hope it does not really mean anything, but I am going to, you know, go by it. I'm going to make my own safeguards to be careful about this. So even though I've been sober over 30 years now, I go to my regular meeting, I have my home group, I do 12-step work, and I have a lot of daily contact every day.
It would be nice if we could have a copy of your survey for our archives.
Well, you see what I did with it? As soon as I made all my tabulations, I said, boy, I'm going to have to be extra careful in the face of this.
Right.
I tore them all up, threw them away.
Oh.
After all, they were only some of my stuff.
Right.
I had no advice on how to go about it. No professional told me what I best do or anything.
Right.
I just went ahead and did what I did.
Right.
And while I was out there, I stopped in a little Reno, Nevada club room.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy in there, and I got to talking to him and making my little survey, and he'd been sober many years. And he had been talking to a guy named Jim Burwell, who was living in San Diego. And so Jim had gone home and written him a letter, and he had made an enclosure. And he had listed a lot of people, and he said the following contributed to the founding of AA between June 35 and February 39. And he listed a lot of people in Akron, Ohio, and a lot of people in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that was from 35 to 39.
Mm-hmm.
And then he put down what he considered AA members, he says, as they came in and remained active prior to February 39. That's when the big book came out.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know he only listed 16?
Oh, really?
He listed 1 in 34, Bill Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
2 in 35, Bob Smith, Bill Dotson. 2 in 36, Walter Bray and J.D. Holmes. 37 were 2, Fitzmayo and Dick Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
38 was Jim Burwell, Jack Darrow, Clarence Snyder, Jim Scott, Earl Treat, Archie Trowbridge, and 39 was Abby Goldrich, Burt Taylor, and Tom Burrell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all that he lists as those who came in and remained active prior to February 39.
No, that was his opinion.
And, you know, well, he was one of the oldest ones, you know.
Right.
He came in the same time as Clarence Snyder did. He came in January, and Clarence Snyder came in May.
Right.
And I don't know if he's got a story in the big book or not. So I thought this was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So he talked at San Jose while I was out there, and I went down to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this little thing tucked in my pocketbook because I'd asked the man if I could copy his letter, and he said yes, and I copied it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him where I picked it up and who's what the guy's name was. And I said, now, can you look at this and tell me as near as possible if you remember ever writing this?
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, your writing. And so he looked at it, he says, yeah, as near as I can remember, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime later, I took it to Clarence Snyder, and he looked at it, and I said, can you verify this for me, that this is somewhat like the way it was? And he looked at it, and he said, it sounds pretty okay to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, at least there's something there for me to go on.
Yeah. About what year was that, Lucy?
That was in 61 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
It was 61 when he wrote the letter, I think, and 62 when I was making the trip. Yeah, I made the trip in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the letter was a 61 letter.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of things like that, and I'm real interested now because they have this new book out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what's the name of it? It's got a green book jack on it.
The Pass
It On.
Mm-hmm, right.
And there's so many things in there that I had heard about and learned in my travels in AA,
mm-hmm.
both up in the Northeast and both out west.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into many old-timers who came in the late 30s and early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many things that were mentioned in the Pass It On that I had already heard of, but when I would mention them to other AA members, they thought I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say, no, that couldn't be, that couldn't be.
You and know? This verified it.
And so I tried wherever I could to talk to old-timers and verify things and
mm-hmm.
ask them things that I was questioning about. But at any rate, that gets along now to the place where I have now stayed sober for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
About 1962 would make it about 10 years.
Right.
No, not 10 years, about 8 years. And I was approaching the 10th year deal.
Mm-hmm.
So one night I was sitting in the Carl Room in Miami, and that's an AA room down there. It's not a club officially, but it's an AA meeting room. And an old timer from Chicago was in there that I enjoyed. He was kind of a rough, tough guy from a very wealthy family, but he'd been down to where he thought he'd always have security as long as there were signs saying dishwasher wanted.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been pretty rough road. And he said, Lucy, come here, I want to talk to you. I said, okay. What's up? And he says, this is my 10th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so happy birthday. Because I still didn't see any use making him do birthdays. He
mm-hmm.
said, no, he says, I'm a real troubled man tonight. I said, what's the matter? And he said, I realized today for the first time in my life that I have never stayed sober a day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
My first contact with AA was in jail. And a guy came to me and I hated his guts on sight. And he told me all about AA and staying sober. And he said that he had told me then he had been sober 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I made up my mind then that if that guy, as bad as I am, found him to be, and as much as I didn't like him,
mm-hmm.
if he could do it for 10 years, I could too. And he said, you know, I just realized this morning that I've been working for my 10th birthday ever since I got sober.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, this morning I woke up and I have achieved my goal. I have been sober 10 years. Now what the heck am I going
to
do? And he says, I've been disturbed all day.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it really is something to realize that, you know, I've achieved what I set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, suddenly I realized I've never been in AA. I've been on some private 10-year goal of my own.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked AA everywhere. I've been back and forth. I've done 12-step work. But he says, I myself, this morning, I don't have a feeling of ever having been in AA.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I don't know what to do. I says, why don't you try it anyway, one day at a time?
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he hugged my neck and he said, you know, he says, that's just what the reason I called you over, because he said, suddenly I realized maybe I'm going to have to stay sober a day at a time, not 10 years.
Right.
And he was always a good buddy of mine, and he died in the last couple of years. But I always thought that was amazing. He could just as easy have gone out and got drunk, having received his, you know, achieved his goal.
Right.
But he's protected by being surrounded by AA members in an AA environment.
Right.
And I thought that was great.
Really?
But, you know, all I've done now for years and years is practice the things that I learned to do, learn when I can, get new information when I can. And since I know that most of the people, and you sometime back, that most of the people I sobered up with, should I live long,
mm-hmm.
probably would be passed on or gotten bored and left or don't go to meetings anymore or some of these things,
right.
that I was going to have to depend on young people to keep me sober.
Right.
And I have been working with young people for years and years. I started in Miami. I went to work with them more in Cape Canaveral, when I went out and lived in San Francisco for a year, and then I went to Honolulu and taught school and stayed for a year. And always my focus is toward the younger people. They're the ones who will keep me alive.
Right.
And that's what I do, and now I don't start new groups anymore. I encourage the younger people.
Right.
When you stay in a group for a year or two and you feel like you're getting healthy and all, you need to know what it is to be in a group. Then
right.
you need to know how to start one, so that no matter where you go, if there isn't a group, or if the kind of group there is something that leaves you sort of cold, you know how to start your own group.
Mm-hmm.
So here in St. Petersburg, there is the 104 group that used to be young people's years ago, and there is the Et Cetera group, which was an offshoot. There was a 3T group, but they lost their meeting place, and they've sort of haven't got together again, although I understand now they're in the process of forming a new group to meet on Sunday night. There's a little group of youngsters that branched out and started their own and invited us to join them, called Today's Stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're all just offshoots.
Right.
And they're all AA groups, and they're learning. They're learning how to be GSRs. They're learning how to be group representatives, and none of them want to do that. Most of them came through treatment centers.
Right.
And what I find, I don't know if you've ever been in a treatment center, but what I find in treatment centers is the accent is you got to do the fourth step before you get out.
Mm-hmm.
We are AA oriented.
Mm-hmm.
We have AA meetings here. And meetings are the thing. When you get out of here, go to meetings, go to meetings. 90 meetings, 90 days, or some such stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing is given about the group.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is shown that, you know, people are more comfortable if they join a group and become a part of something, you know, and if they have to move later on, they can go find another group and join that.
Right.
You can't belong to AA at large.
Right.
Not very easily. And I find it, you know, I wish treatment centers, if they're going to claim to be AO-oriented, I wish their staff members would learn more about group affiliation.
Right.
Because groups have been my lifesaver. Members of my group, contact with my group, my regular meeting every week, whether I feel like it or not, these are all important things. You know, that back up my staying sober day at the time.
Right.
And I feel real badly that they don't have this group invitation. I feel real badly when I see newcomers come to our groups. And I go down to St. Petersburg group a lot because that's the best fishing place I ever saw. The room is always full of people.
Mm-hmm.
There's always new drunks in there.
Right.
And I go down there, and in addition to taking the phones occasionally for the central office, I go down there and look and get acquainted with the newer faces, the newer people who's sitting there drunk, you know, introduce
right.
myself, hand out my phone number, and things like that.
Right.
To me, you know, this AA way of life means 24 hours a day, and it means in all departments. It has to do with house cleaning and jobs and kitty cats and puppy dogs
right.
and family, you know, and their opinions. I had talked to a girl this morning. She called me from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother had heard something on TV last night about AA's 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you don't know how mortified your father and I feel that you're a member of our family who goes to this AA.
Oh.
And of course, she was all crushed.
Right.
You know, and I tried to give her a way to look at it.
Right.
So there are just many things like this that to me, AA is a way of life. It's a way that I live every day to maintain my sobriety.
Right.
And it's solely dependent on using other people.
I'm going to go back a little bit as far as, excuse me, the comments you might have, like in the contact with the General Service Office, and if there was an intergroup or a central office in the early days. Do you have any recollection of that, like in the real early days?
There wasn't one here until 1960, I understand.
Uh-huh.
But in Miami, there was one that operated for the whole of Dade County.
Right.
But whenever we set up our sobriety house out on the beach, we found that there wasn't any 12-step worker calls except a tape recorder or something
mm-hmm.
that somebody picked up at 9 o'clock in the morning the next morning operating. Mm-hmm. So out there we got together and we went to the telephone company to see what we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And we purchased something they call a BIM line,
mm-hmm.
where an answering service picks up the call.
Okay.
And then they call you at home.
I see.
And so we had it fixed so that no matter what hour of the day or night, we would get the calls. And
uh-huh.
we listed it as alcoholic information.
Right.
Because they had a central office.
Did they have like the intergroup meetings?
For Miami Beach.
Right. Was there intergroup meetings and?
There were in the Dade County one, and the little one on the beach. There were only four groups out there.
Uh huh.
So we didn't form an intergroup. We just called it alcohol information. But we visited all the other groups back
yeah.
and forth. They were all familiar. They came to our meetings too. The ones at Sobriety House, I don't mean mine and my
mm-hmm.
husband's, I mean Sobriety House groups that met there.
Right.
And they came over to meetings there, and gradually we all learned, you know, who to call for 12-step work and when.
Right.
And people, there were many people on the beach who, some of them were from the wealthier families, had lovely homes and so forth, and a lot of children.
Mm-hmm.
And those people did not feel free in every case
mm-hmm.
to take 12-step people home with them.
Right.
And there still was not all this detox centers and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that going on.
Did
so
you have...
we had, at Sobriety House, we had 8 couches
uh-huh.
in that long living room where we held meetings.
Right.
And anyone who had a 12-step call who wanted to bring their person over there, as long as they would stay with them and work with them,
right.
were permitted to do so. They couldn't bring somebody over there and dump them.
Right.
But they could take them over there and work with them.
Now, when you were still in Pinellas County at your Pasadena group, did that group have any contact at all with the General Service Office?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. At that time, my job was to make coffee and make donuts. If there was such a thing as a secretary or anything, I don't know who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about officers in the group. There certainly was no meeting. There was no business meeting. There was nothing like that that I knew of the whole year that I belonged there.
I see. Uh-huh.
And when I left there, I'd been there for over a year to
right.
that one group. And I didn't ever hear about any business meetings. I never heard about secretaries or
right.
CSRs or intergroups. And if they didn't have one until 1960, I couldn't have.
No.
Apparently everything started with Ma and Pa down at Sunshine,
uh-huh.
and apparently their members, everything else was an offshoot of that,
right.
and people were close enough that they just got on the phones with each other
yeah.
whenever something came
Who
up.
Were Ma and Pa?
I don't know if I could use their last names. I suppose I could, but if anybody ever knows, that listens to this tape from the local area, the older ones will all know who Ma and Pa were.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I should use their names?
I don't know if that would be required or not, even their first names.
Because they are both dead so far as I know.
I see.
But as far as I know, they both were instrumental in starting AA here.
Right.
I don't know who all is listed in the archives and have started it, but Ma and Pa were their rather affectionately known names.
I see.
And so they had a lot to do with the early AA in Pinellas County long before I came along.
Right.
The whole thing was loose. It was not organized.
Yes, and that's what I think is something that all the pain that the early groups went through to hang together. It you see that the purpose to them, their sobriety was the main purpose, and they had very little to work with but each other.
Well, stay sober was the thing.
Right.
And it took me a long time to go through the confusion
right.
Of all the things that you hear, you know.
Yeah.
You hear it's not too good when you first sober up anyway.
Yeah.
At least mine wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't want to put that on other people, but it's a long time to be done.
Yeah.
Many simple things. But I do stay sober. I do go to my regular meeting. That gives me a priority check. If I begin to find excuses for not going to my meeting, I'm already in trouble.
Right.
And I do have daily contacts and 12-step work when I can get it. And all my philosophy of living and my religious beliefs are my ventures into trying to learn new information and so forth, that's all something else that goes on.
Right.
There's another thing. I found that, you know, a lot of times you work for praise or credit or something like that. I learned another simple little lesson as I went along, one that you can get a lot done if you don't care who gets the credit.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit looking for credit.
Right.
And the other thing was, you're always looking for a payoff.
Uh-huh.
And I learned that staying sober is my payoff. Maintaining my sobriety is my payoff. And that I don't have to look for other payoffs. And if I do what I believe keeps me sober, that I get reinforced all the time from the strangest places by the strangest people in ways that I could not invent. If I say, well, you know, I don't want to do that anymore, it's not paying off to me.
Right.
That means I've named what kind of payoff I want.
Uh-huh.
I've named when I want it. And I have named who's going to do it. And I figure that, you know, after a long period of time, I thought, gee, that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Work at staying sober. Do what you know you have to do to be an AA and to live sober every day, no matter where it's dishwashing or the fact that your mama's sick in a rest home, you know, how do you deal with that in an AA way?
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that in a maintained sobriety way to stay in the now? And I get reinforced. I always do. But I can't pick out how, when, or where.
Right.
Staying sober carries its own reinforcement.
Right.
God knows drinking carried its own reinforcement practically to the grave.
Yeah.
And it was good medicine. I feel that I always drank medicinally. I drank for the benefits I got out of it.
Yeah.
I took drugs for the benefits that I had learned to get out of them.
Right.
And I stay sober for the benefits I know I get every day.
Right. Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing with us. This will really be very, very welcome as part of our archives.
Well, it's been long enough.
Right. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. So our tape is about to the end now, so I'll stop it.
All right, honey. Now, did you want to me to say whether this can be used or not?
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, I would leave that up to the judgment of the Archives Committee.
Okay.
For any other use that they would see fit. I'm sure that the Archives Committee is very familiar with all the traditions in AA.
Right.
And as long as the traditions are not offended in any way, then I see no reason why it could be used.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All righty.